On dance night, I would pretend it was my own in the silent hours inside my cabin. Harriet mused. I'd sure like to serve him a big slice of my peach pie, she sighed dreamily. With a piece of steel wool, I knocked the rust off the corner of a license plate. Why in the world is Jackson fooling with that nasty beast of yours? She asked, and then turned to me, accidentally brushing against my sleeve. Harriet screwed up her mouth, jerked her arm back, and jiggled it as if to shake off a bug. She was afraid to touch me. The supervisor had reluctantly trained me for my route, but for only one day before abandoning me to go at it alone the very next. I've been training and teaching the thick-headed blue a full week, she'd fibbed to Eula Foster. I snuck a glance back to Jackson and Junia, then mumbled a sideways apology to her for the contact, moved a step away, inspected another plate, and went to work on bending it. Why, look at you, Blewett, Harriet cried. I glanced up, Harriet's loud voice startling me. Harriet's eyes flashed, a crawl of anger lit across, and then she spit out, Your face is ripening into a blueberry. Why, it looks like an ink blot, she laughed. Don't she look like an ugly old ink blot, Eula? Her scorn slashed at me, cutting. Sometimes I thought my embarrassment, my shame, was exactly what Harriet wanted to see, trying hard to poke and make it happen. I pressed a hand to my cheek and watched her lace-colored face crinkle and harden. Harriet plucked at her sleeves, flicked her fingers down her arms, and then stomped back to her work table, each step feeling like a kick to my gut. Settling noisily into her seat, she turned up the radio. Outside, Junior shrieked and just as quick quieted. Jackson stood in front of her at a safe distance now with the apple and talked to her. Junia turned her head, sneaking a side eye, then tossed her nose back and took the apple from his outstretched hand. I couldn't help but laugh softly and then glimpsed over my shoulder at Harriet, busy with her mail. I turned back and gave Jackson Lovett a small appreciative smile. Then he walked up to the window. Cussy Mary? A friend lent me a new book, and I wondered if you'd heard of it. Curious, I leaned out. Fair to Lance? He took it out from his coat pocket. I turned and looked at Harriet, thumbing through a magazine, loudly humming the tune playing on the radio, before answering him. Yes, sir, I kept a low voice. That's the first in Rex Stout's Nero Wolfe series. A fine detective novel and mystery. You don't say. I do like myself a good mystery. His eyes were mischievous. Thank you, Cussy Mary. He touched a finger to his head, struck off a friendly goodbye, a pat to Junia's rump, and strolled away. Puzzled, I watched him until he rounded a corner. When I'd finished with the bookends, I moved over to a stack of boxes filled with reading material that had just come in and poured through the new donations. This was the best part of my job. Going through other big-town libraries' cast-offs, always surprised by the countless treasures those richer folks thought worthless to be thrown away. I pulled out two books, studied on which one to give Angeline, then set aside The Tale of Mrs. Tittlemouse for her. Then I eyed two baby care pamphlets and saved those. A Dr. Doolittle book was at the bottom, and I dug it out, inspected, then tucked it away for a dear patron. Digging deeper, I spotted an old English grammar textbook from a Chicago school. It was a perfect find, and the pages weren't torn or missing. I'd study the lesson book and then pass it on to Angeline. Maybe I'd have time to learn all the lessons so I could give her a few. To my surprise, I came across a novel that looked new, one that Harriet had been dying to read. The Stars Look Down. I weighed it in my hand, thinking about keeping it to read first. She loved the Scottish author and had been hankering to read his latest about an English mining town. If she found out I hadn't given it to her, there'd be hell to pay. Maybe the book would turn her sour mood into a more agreeable one. I walked over to her and held it up, hoping it would. Suspicious, she looked at the book, then back to me like I'd set a rabbit snare. I note how much you like Mr. Cronin's books, I said, placing it on her table, trying to brave a friendly smile for her. She snatched it up, but not before I heard a gravelly, thank you, and saw the pleasure in her eyes. Brand new. It sure looks like a grand one, I told her. Why, yes, yes. Oh, Three Loves of Lucy Moore was a grand one, you know. A masterpiece. When he drowned? The way she devoted herself to her son? All for naught? A tragedy. Harriet flashed a sad smile that softened her. I'd read the book, too. The character Lucy was prideful, a determined pauper who could only have victory and worth through men. The monastery scene in Belgium? Harriet prattled. When she... The assistant supervisor stopped herself and stared up at me. I loved the way Harriet loved her books. It changed her into something different. Better. And for a minute, I forgot who she was. Who I wasn't. Oh, blew it. Blew it! She snapped her fingers in front of my face, scattering my thoughts. Get to work! Harriet griped, though I could tell she was pleased to get the novel, even more to talk about it as if she were an expert on books. I stiffened my silly grin. Yes, ma'am. I went back to my station and dug into another box for magazines and came up empty. Instead, I found a Vogue pattern for children's smocks and took it for the scrapbooks. There was some old sheet music that Winnie Parker, the schoolmarm, would love to have. I grabbed a few more health and hygiene pamphlets and put them in my growing pile. Pleased, I stacked them neatly and moved on to the next carton, searching for a farmer's almanac for a patron who'd requested one. I dug deeper and broke off a piece of my nail looking for any Steinbeck books. I found an old 1935 June magazine with a lady wearing a fairy tale wedding dress on the glossy cover, and several books for Orrin Taft, who was on my Friday route. He was the holler dweller who lived over the mountain. I travel all day to get reading material to him for his small community. Despite the wearing day and unpredictable paths, it was always worth the journey to see his friendly face. Under a pile of old textbooks and Reader's Digests, I spied a newspaper and grabbed it for the Smith household. The paper, dated May 5th, 1936, was practically new, and not like the ones we usually got, often outdated by a month or more. Feeling a rush circle my neck and flush upward, I rubbed my indigo-washed hands, thrilled at my find. Pressing the newsprint to my chest, I buried my nose in the still fresh ink and inhaled. It was the Louisville Times. I scanned the headlines about a gambling place that was raided in the city, read about Italy's invasion of a strange place called Ethiopia, then searched the pages and saw an even stranger advertisement for a lady's swimming costume costing a whole $6.95, what would feed several Hill families for a week. It was drab fabric, and not much of it either, but it showed a lot and drew the eye over every inch of the city woman's body. Astonished, I couldn't take my eyes off the skin-tight dark union suit, the lady's shapely breasts, thighs, and legs slithering inside it. I came to my senses and guiltily flicked to a new page, fearing I'd witnessed something odd and knowing folks here would find it vulgar. I stole a glance at the supervisor. She'd surely censor it, destroying the pages like she did Mom's The Painted Veil that had been donated and any other reading materials she said would offend, taint, or tempt the morals of the deeply spiritual mountain folk. After turning more pages, my eyes rested on a flowered dress that cost $12.88. The slick city woman wore a draping flax blue linen dress with a white scalloped border, matching felt hat, and clean white gloves. A bolded advertisement above the picture read, "Next Sunday is Mother's Day." I ran a finger over the clothing, sifting through my thoughts of her. Mom had had one good dress, and it was the same color. The very same one that matched mine. For months and beyond, I would feel the swish of her cottony sky blue skirts lingering on my skin as I picked up her duties, tended the daily chores in a home wrecked by aching loss, with Pa the stranger now, toppled in that grief. Occasionally, I'd stop to tilt my face into the ghosted airs of her fabric and fold a prayer into my sorrow. How I ached for her, recalling her head bent to candlelight, her slender fingers dipping into beeswax to coat the thread to strengthen tired old string, her swift, graceful hands working stitches into the fabric, her sharp teeth biting snips of thread, her nimble fingers nodding while I sat at her feet, watching her rhythms birth a hymn sweeter than any birdsong. "Widow Fraser," the head librarian Eula Foster called out, walking up behind me and snapping the paper out of my hands. I'll take that. And Widow Fraser, oh, please tether that bad-tempered beast of yours to the back of the building. Not on the side, she's causing a ruckus and scaring passers-by. At her work table, Harriet whistled through her teeth over the bookbinding and said, I don't know how you put up with such an ornery creature, Blewett. Honestly, I done shot it for meat and skinned it at the tree you took her from. I nearly jumped out of my skin and bumped into Queenie Johnson, the 32-year-old Negro packhorse librarian. That mule's a nuisance, Eula grumbled. It weren't like Junia to fuss in this familiar place. I'll take care of her, I whispered a pardon to Queenie. As I turned to go outside, I noticed Queenie was wounded. Alarmed, I asked, what happened? Just a nip. Queenie held up a scraped hand tracked with tiny specks of blood. Only a scratch, honey. Old Junia got the devil inside her when the pastor happened by. He hit her with his stick and she tramped around, tried for a piece of him and done tore his coat sleeve almost off. Queenie choked back a giggle, pressing her knuckles to her mouth. Harriet nailed Queenie with a stony glare and said, Pastor Fraser baptized both my nieces. A fine, God-fearing man that shouldn't be bothered by filthy beasts. She struck the last word and batted it to us. Queenie ignored her, pursed her lips, and quieted. The pastor whacked her 3 more times, so I figured I would help him out and calm her some, but Junia, well, that old girl went for him again with those big, ugly, green-stained teeth. She missed once and plumb nabbed me instead. Oh, Queenie, I said. She didn't mean it, though, and I could tell by her sorrowful eyes that she felt bad. Queenie grinned. I looked past her. Through the screen door, I spotted Vester Fraser across the street under the concrete lip of the company store, dragging a stick along the sun-baked bricks, cutting a mean eye my way. A cold fear struck and had me reaching for the door to steady. Blewett, back to work, Harriet warned. I turned to reply, yes, ma'am. And then I saw what I hadn't seen before. And I suddenly knowed her fat hands had been under those cold baptizing creek waters with the preachers and his followers when they drowned the Goodwin babies and the others. Looking at Harriet's open hatred set hot on her face, and then back outside to Fraser, I felt ill, hunted. The preacher shot me a hard grin, sending me backward, stumbling into Queenie again. Harriet grumbled to Eula. I see Bertie's late again. I'm going to make that girl come in next week, and she ain't leaving for her routes until she's inventoried all our holdings and given us a full day in them stacks. Queenie placed a hand on my shoulder. You okay, honey? Honey? Yes, yes. I looked back out and saw he was gone. I'm so sorry she bit you. Does it hurt? Let me clean it for you. I glanced back to the street once more. Empty. Relieved, I nudged my chin to the tiny alcove, meaning to lead Queenie into the new lady's powder room and wash the wound, maybe freshen my face with cold water, but Eula stepped in front of us. She jabbed a finger up to the new, no-colored sign above the lady's door. Queenie stared down at the tops of her shoes. Before she became a packhorse librarian, Queenie had applied to the program 5 times, and had always been turned down. I'd seen her applications, and they looked better than most. Each time, Queenie'd write her name perfect and correct and give her age and all the proper information. And each time, she was denied. Last summer, Queenie had visited the center and asked for another application, but Harriet refused to give her one. The next month, Queenie came back. I was in the headquarters sorting when she barged in and dropped a letter onto Eula's desk and announced, says I have a job. Says so right here from the Women's Professional Project in Louisville, Kentucky. Eula bent over and read out loud the WPA's order instructing her to give Queenie Johnson a packhorse librarian route, her voice souring to the ending. The supervisor's face paled to a wedding dress white, and she crumpled the letter, single-fisted, ordering Queenie to wait outside. Harriet turned as blue-faced as me, scattering her neatly stacked piles of church pamphlets, and threw 2 books across the room one striking my arm. In the end, Queenie was called back in and given a book to read out loud. It was the only requirement of the Pack Horse Project for the job, and usually the read was a children's storybook at that. Queenie breezed through it, then pulled out a dictionary from her bag and read 2 pages, and better than any of us. Eula gave her a long and treacherous route, second to mine, and when Harriet refused to train her, Eula left it to me. Queenie was suspicious of me at first, but by midweek she'd warmed into her route and shyly offered me half of her fat biscuit. We'd stopped by the creek to break, and I shared my apple and she talked about her family. We chatted on about books, went over the routes and patrons, and both marveled how lucky we were to be packhorse librarians, doing important pioneer library work, as the WPA administrator reminded us. I told Queenie how I'd done the same as her and bypassed Eula by sending the job application directly to the bosses in the city. Queenie told me her husband Franklin had been killed in a mine explosion, same as her pa, leaving her to fend for her 3 small boys and her widowed ailing grandma. Her mama died from the fever, and the tiny family was all she had now. Again, Eula stabbed the air, pointing to the sign. "Best go, Cussie," Queenie said. "I'll see you Wednesday as usual." She walked over to her table to gather her bags. I stared up at the sign. It seemed a bad waste of paint and fine wood, of city running water and the fancy indoor latrine installed this winter, when there were outhouses scattered around town. Weren't but a handful of coloreds around these parts anyway. Queenie, her kids, and her grandma Willow. There was Doc's housekeeper, Aletha, the woman who'd come from a place called Jamaica. 8, counting me and Pa. Eula wagged her finger, but this time at me, her shaming eyes landed on mine. "You're only allowed in to clean it, Widow Fraser." I looked down, knowing my place, knowing I was the one they were really afraid of, detested most. It was difficult enough being colored, much less being my odd, ugly color and the last colored of my kind. Somehow, folks like Harriet and Eula made it worse, made sure their color, any color, was better than mine. I was an affliction on their kind and mankind, and I was to stay put and exactly where they wanted to keep me put, beneath them, always and alone. "You know the rules, blues and coloreds outside," Eula said, shaking her head, darting her nervous eyes between Queenie and me. "We can't have you using the indoor facilities. We wouldn't want a chance passing on a..." "Well, we just can't have it." Harriet jumped out of her seat, sending her chair tumbling backward. "Good heavens," she screeched and pressed a fat finger to her warted jaw. "Why, they could pass a disease. Take yourselves outside to the well pump right now. And take that filthy beast home, Blewett, before I shoot it myself." Her eyes said she'd do just that, and would like to do the same to me. I scampered for my things and shot out the door past a bewildered Birdie, almost spinning the young packhorse librarian around. Chapter 9. The following Monday, I made it to Angeline's, only to find her missing. I didn't want to disturb Mr. Moffat, so I dawdled out in the yard, wasting a good 20 minutes before reckoning she was out hunting food. Junia slow-poked along the paths. "Gee," I pleaded when she stalled on the trail where we'd seen Fraser. I looked all around, rubbing the chills on my neck. After a few minutes, my nerves crawled and I yelled, "We're late! Gee up!" She wouldn't budge, and I became frantic and climbed down, searching the woods with a sharp eye, dragging her onto another long path that cost us more time. When I mounted, she picked up speed, perking her ears to make sure he weren't coming after her. Bent, I scrunched down close to her head, keeping my eyes wide to make sure, too. We rode on to my next 3 cabins and left loans on the stoops of thimble-sized homes. I didn't have a book for Mr. Lovett, so I journeyed on past to my next patrons. In the dust-bitten yard, a leaning chicken coop and tiny wooden goat pen nestled beside the tall one-room school, its chestnut harvested from the forest, the log gaps daubed with mud and grasses. Smoke percolated from the chimney, curling over black hand-split shingles and skittering up the side of a craggy treed hill. The school door was shut, the yard empty of students. Junior called out a bossy neigh to the goat, and two chickens flew up from their perch and squawked back. From inside the schoolhouse, small faces peeked out the narrow windows. I heard the scrambling of little feet and the sounds of smothered giggles before the door swung open. Teacher Winnie Parker pushed through the doorway with a flared skirt of eight scruffy youngins circling her. The 36-year-old woman clapped her hands when she saw me. I dismounted and Winnie exclaimed, "Cussy Mary, you're here!" She grabbed the reins and passed them to one of her older pupils. "Come with me, Miss Junior," the girl said and trotted the mule over to the hitching post. "Bookwoman's here," the student sang. "She's here sure enough," a littler one piped up. "Miss Bookwoman, I have you a big surprise." A small girl missing her milk teeth pushed forward, waving a scrap of paper. "Mama said to give you her counterpane pattern for your scrapbooks." I took the note and saw it was for a knitted, cross-centered bed cover with a knotted fringe border. "That'll make a pretty counterpane, and a lot of folks will appreciate knitting it. Thank your mama for me," I said, inspecting the pattern again before slipping it into my pocket. The girl blushed and gave a small curtsy before scrambling behind Winnie and the others. A boy rushed up to me. "Miss Bookwoman, I need a book about the war, about the World War. I'm going to grow up and go to fight." Another little boy said, "I want a book about China, like the one you brought us last year." "It was the Chinese twins the Perkins lady done wrote," a girl in tatty braids proudly announced. "Lucy, I reckon was her name." "Lucy Fitch Perkins," I said, impressed. "Yep, the Chinese twins," the boy brightened. "And I'm gonna take the big locomotive and live there, soon as I growed a little more, my ma says." I loved that the books were growing their little minds. Pa was wrong. They needed books more than anything else this place had to offer. They were starved for the learning, the know-how on leaving this hard land for a better, softer one. Winnie said, "Time to let her get her books." "I brought you two new ones," I told Winnie. Winnie's eyes popped. "Two? Heavens!" Usually I couldn't get but one, but last Wednesday Queenie had slipped it to me from her own bundle. "Farmer Boy and Mountain Path," I announced. "Got something for you too, ma'am." Winnie clapped her slender hands once more, shooing the class back into the schoolhouse. "Stay seated," she called to them before turning back to me. "Let's go have a look at the reading material." I pulled out books from my bags, then dug around and found the rolled-up magazine and handed it to her. "Oh," Winnie peeked at it, the partly slick but tattered cover splatted with tape, its back replaced with stiff paperboard. She fanned through the dog-eared pages. "You remembered. It was finally returned, and I knowed how you wanted the loan. You keep it as long as you like, ma'am." "Thank you. This'll keep me company until Albert gets home." She pressed the Love Story magazine to her face, breathing in the ink. "I'll take good care of it." The magazine was one I'd kept in circulation for the women who secretly requested excitement reads, the one I'd snuck out of the center last year before the supervisor could approve it, knowing she wouldn't allow it. The one I kept hidden from Pa. Winnie had spent a long winter cooped up in her attic nest above the classroom where she slept. Nobody else in the hills had the room or food to take in a teacher like that. Her man up and moved to Detroit to work in the big factory and hadn't come back for her yet. A lot of mountaineers sought work in the city, leaving behind their wives until they could care for them proper, get ahead with a few paychecks. I figured Winnie was lonesome, same as me. And any type of reading softened that. "Weren't no trouble," I said, meaning it and feeling proud I'd gotten the magazine for her. I handed her the sheet music.
"Oh, new music too? My lord, thank you."
She examined the sheets. Then, "How's Elijah?" "Good, thank you for asking. But he has himself some long hours of mining, and they's working him before his time. These hills birth the old. How are you this week, Cussy Mary?"
"I'm fit."
Out of habit, I tucked my hands into my pocket, hiding the coloring, though it weren't necessary here, and my skin was a comfortable gray-blue. When he'd been the only one to come calling after Charlie Frazier died, the only one to bring a pie and sit with me one long Sunday, and then the very next reading to me while I recovered from Frazier's beating. She never asked what happened or pried none, and I never offered, but I could see the understanding in her eyes. A mixture of concern and anger in there, too. Last summer, I'd been caught in a fierce summer storm, and Winnie had insisted on making me a pallet beside the school's wood stove for the night. It didn't feel right sleeping in a room below a patron, so when the rain quieted before midnight, I'd folded the quilts, stacked them, slipped out to Junia, and headed home, our lantern lighting our way like a bright firefly. The drizzling rain illuminated in swaying yellow shadows, combing the path ahead. "Cussie Mary," Winnie held up a book, "do you have a few minutes to read to them?" I loved the way she said my name. Always called me by my given one, never once by the doc's old nickname, or worse, the new title, Widow Frazier. She had kindly asked my partiality long ago when we'd met. 10 minutes, maybe," Winnie coaxed. I didn't have myself even one, much less 10 of them minutes. Junia had rode slow today, and waiting on Angeline had eaten up 20 of them. These hills stole a whole lot, too, what with the lazy sun struggling to climb over the mountains and the nights dropping fat and fast. Time was something there weren't enough of in these parts. My route was 17.5 miles as the crow flies, but longer by mule. I was already late for my next stop. It'd be dark when I got home. I'd have to feed and groom Junia, and there was Pa's supper to fix before he went off to the mine, and I'd be left to finish my other chores. But Winnie asked so sweetly, and if I hurried and Junia didn't tarry or get difficult, I might not be too late. "I reckon I have some time for the children," I said. Inside the chalk-dusted schoolroom, Winnie led me over to the piano that butted up to the far wall. A wood axe and cross-stitch sampler of the Ten Commandments hung above the fine upright. An old regulator clock hung from the wall, its pendulum silent. Rough-hewn benches formed a neat line on slanted chestnut planks in front of the teacher's desk. In the corner, a fire crackled, spitting sap and bark inside an old wood stove. Winnie pulled out the piano stool for me. 2 years ago, Doc had donated the pretty mahogany and spruce Storing Clark piano to the school after his wife passed, and he'd made sure to leave Winnie the beautiful red foxskin bench cover he'd bought from a trapper to fancy it. She said it had been the devil getting the horse-drawn wagon to tote the heavy furniture up the mountain. She worried it was too prideful and pretty, but folks came from miles around for the chance to see a real piano like that, to touch the gleaming wood and tap the ivory keys. It was a sight, and to this day, folks still happened by to beg a peek or sneak a shy tapping. Winnie smoothed down the slipping pelt and righted the fox's dangling head, tail, paws, and hind legs. The young'uns gathered on the worn, puncheon floor and sat in front of me in a semicircle. Henry, a frail 10-year-old, scooted close and snuck a rub of the fox's furry feet. He tugged lightly on my skirts. "Bookwoman, ma'am? I love the Peter and Wendy book. Please bring it again." "I'll try, Henry," I smiled warmly. The small boy looked sickly, and I knowed it came from hunger. The mountain children were thinner than the young'uns in the picture books I brought them, and they'd noticed more than once and pointed it out, marveling about the fictional towns the characters lived in and all the food available there. Still, I couldn't help notice again how the students waited for me, looked up at me all quiet, and not a single fidget or wiggle, as hungry for the stories in these books as they were for the food that always seemed sparse in this real land. "Bookwoman," a small girl named Nessie raised her hand. "Can you get me a cookbook next time? Sister is going to pie bake dance in 2 weeks, and she needs herself a good recipe, ma'am." "Pie bake dance, the old maid's chance," several boys sang out, making kiss-smacking noises until Winnie clapped her hands. "I'm happy to bring one for your sister," I said. We always had church cookbooks coming in from around the state, and there would be recipes in the newspapers and magazines. I opened Laura Ingalls Wilder's book and read the first chapter of Farmer Boy. 15 minutes later, I finished. Henry raised his hand. "Ma'am, I'm going to be a librarian like you when I get growed up." A few boys snickered. "You ain't a growing up, and you ain't a girl, stupid." Am too, Henry said to the boys. Peter and Wendy says all children growed up, and I'm going to be a librarian if I want.
Ain't true, one snipped back. It said except one. That's you, stupid.
Hurt, Henry shrank back. Winnie glared her disapproval, quieting them. Clementine, an older girl sitting back on her legs, popped up on her knees and said,
I want to join the pack horse, bookwoman.
Cause you ain't never going to get yourself hitched, beanpole, said a tall, barefoot boy sitting next to her in baggy pants and a tattered shirt who yanked her braid. Clementine punched his arm. He tried to pinch her back, nabbing her shoulder.
Here, I can help, he whispered as a tease. You ain't blue enough.
Winnie gave a sharp, scolding clap.
Quiet!
I softly cleared my throat and told the class, the pack horse librarians aren't just for girls. We have a man who rides over in Woodford now. And Master Norton? I said to the boy who'd pulled Clementine's braid, we also have ourselves women in the project who are widowed with young'uns. I heard of at least two other women whose husbands had left them to find work in the city factories. The librarians had fibbed to the WPA and said they'd been abandoned so they could feed their family until their men sent for them. Norton dropped his head and murmured,
sorry, yes, ma'am.
Several students raised their hands, wriggling for permission to talk. Winnie clapped her hands again for a hush.
Let's thank Bookwoman for her visit, boys and girls.
Outside, I said goodbye to the teacher and mounted Junia.
See you soon. Be safe, Cussie Mary, Winnie said, rubbing the mule's ear.
Henry ran out of the schoolhouse.
Bookwoman! Miss Bookwoman, wait!
He looked at his teacher, feet itching, a plea of permission in his weak eyes. Winnie said,
be quick, Henry. We've kept her long enough. Miss Bookwoman, I've been saving this for you, he said, breathless, and then thrust out a grubby fist with a wadded up piece of paper inside.
I got it for winning Mrs. Parker's spelling bee, he beamed. Winnie placed a hand on his bony ribbed back.
That's right, she said. Henry spelled all his words with nary a hitch.
Henry passed it to Winnie, who reached up and dropped the gift into my hand. I peeled back a piece of the paper wrapper, and Henry cried,
don't undo it, ma'am, don't, until you feel a mite hungry.
Thank you. I'll save it then, I said, pocketing the curious little package.
Has the new baby come, Henry?
I remembered he'd mentioned a new baby back in December.
No, ma'am, but Ma thinks it'll be here soon. She's gotten too big to walk me partway to school now. She says I'm big enough to come all the way by myself.
Most of the school children did walk miles by themselves. A few had brothers and sisters to join them. Others would meet up with students along the way if they were lucky enough to live nearby.
It'll be nice having yourself another brother or sister, I said.
Yes, ma'am. I'm hoping this one'll live. He scrunched up his small face, worrying the thought. Shifting his body, he nudged the dirt with a bare toe. Henry's ribs jutted from a thin shirt that was too small, his collarbone cut sharp, an unnatural easel for his pallid face. His mama had lost the last one, or was it the last two? I couldn't remember. There were always new babies in the mountains if you didn't count the dying ones. A new little one, I said, trying to sound warm and positive, and a tad excited.
I like the new babies best, Henry grinned.
Give her my best wishes.
I can spell pineapple, wanna hear? Henry boasted.
That's a mighty big word, I said and waited. Winnie had spelling contests from the books I brought. It always pleased me to be a small part of it.
P-I-N-E-A-P-P-L-E, Henry burst out. And don't you open it none until you're good and hungry.
He scurried back to the schoolhouse.
What could it be? I wondered as I rode off.
Chapter 10. As I left the schoolyard, low gray clouds rolled overhead. In the distance, a dog barked at the thunder, and the scent of passing rain sweetened the swirling billows of ghost fog. I pulled out my great-grandpa's timepiece from under my coat, the silver watch dangling from a leather string hanging around my neck, a gift from my mama, and one that had been handed down to her from her grandpa in France.
Pressing down on its pumpkin crown, I released the latch and the small, bubbled filigree pear case opened. I peeked inside the inner case and noted the black hands on the porcelain dial, then snapped it shut and stuffed it back down into my coat. I left the school and rode into Bear Branch most of the way, walking Junia along the slippery, tree-twisted route near the end, eager to drop off the Time Weekly magazine at Mr. Prynne's homestead and always keeping my eyes and ears sharpened for Fraser. Though the news magazine weren't weekly by the time I got the copy and was 3 months old or more, Mr. Prynne, a widower who'd fought in the Great War, would accept only the Time for his loans. I picked his old copy off the stoop and studied the newer one, the picture of someone with a mouthful of name, an older lady, Abby Green Aldrich Rockefeller, on the cover. The magazine touted that she has a nose for new talent, and I reckoned she might, in her fancy hat, stylish dark dress, and pearls. I rolled up the January edition like Mr. Prynne had asked me long ago and left the magazine stuck between his door jamb and latch. Close to 3:30, so I'd have to hurry now. A few miles into my next drop, Junia stopped, and I realized we'd reached Sawbriar Trace. My old rented mounts used to do the same. Junia didn't mind and had took it easily the last three times, barreled through it even. But today she weren't too keen on taking the trail. "Don't be scared none," I said, skittering down. Carefully, I led the mule along the briar path, smacking away branches with a high, crooked elbow, my head tucked down to escape the thorny bushes. I hated that Junia might get scratched some, but there weren't an easier way to reach our next drop. Tonight, I'd inspect her coat and put salve on any wounds. I needed to remember to ask Pa to clear the growth before it thickened in the summer. In the past, Pa'd insisted on renting Mr. Murphy's horse a few times to comb over my trails for any trouble, saying that if I was bound and determined to tote foolish books, he needed to make sure I'd do it safely. Junia stepped lightly, zigzagging and dithering in her pace. I wetted my tongue with a ticking to hurry her on. A smattering of orange pine needles and rabbit scat dotted the mud trail. Ahead, I spotted a deadfall with a cottontail's leg poking out. My belly rumbled. A family would have themselves a fine meal of rabbit meat, gravy, and biscuits tonight. I liked the tender part of the back the most, and for a minute I could almost taste the delicious meat. I'd eaten the apple and bread I'd brought from home hours ago, sharing pinches with Junia. Lightheaded, I dug into my pocket for Henry's gift. "I'm a mite hungry," I said out loud, stopping. Junia snuffled. I unwrapped the paper and found a tiny lifesaver candy inside. Winnie had shared a nickel roll with me when she'd visited. She was fond of the sweet treats and would reward a good student with a piece. I licked it. Pineapple. The thought of Henry giving me his prize, this treasured bite, sat knotted in my throat. It was a grand thing. The little boy had lost one of his brothers to starvation last year. His pa had run off and his mama was expecting. How long had the child held on to it for me, waiting to give it to me? How many times had the hunger pangs tempted him, set his belly afire for the wanting? Yet his love for words and books was stronger. I covered the lifesaver with the paper and slipped it back into my pocket to save in my tin box where I kept my fine keepsakes. Mama's silver thimble and three brass buttons with the pretty scroll border, her tiny leather Bible, a letter written by my great-grandpa, and Pa's brown bone-handled penknife he'd favored as a boy. "Let's gee, old girl." I climbed atop Junia and plucked a song from my mind, singing for the distraction, quieting my hunger. At the Smith cabin, I rode Junia past the clothesline, a burst of soap and clean cotton swirling around us. The light of fading afternoon canted across grass, folding into the darkening ground. I nudged Junia up to the window. Martha Hannah and her young'uns crammed the warped frame, leaned their heads out, lit with a big cheer from seeing me. The young mama stood peeling an onion. She swatted some of the children away, ordering them back to their chores. "Sorry I'm late, ma'am," I said, feeling bad I'd interrupted her dinner chores. My mouth watered as I peeked past, smelling the skillet of chopped greens frying in grease. A girl poured corn kernels into a heavy pot of boiling water to make hominy, while her sister skinned a rabbit beside her.
No bother at all, bookwoman. Have any of them newspapers in your bags today?
She asked, hoping.
No, ma'am, I said, wishing I'd snuck out the one Eula grabbed.
The city newspapers went fast and were rarely returned. Most folks used the print to paper their cabin walls, keeping out drafts, holding in the warmth and fancying up drab rooms. The little ones made paper dolls out of them.
I'll be sure and try and save you one next time I'm at the center, I said.
Would you have any woman's home companion? She shifted, and I could see she was in the family way again. The companion was a popular request. Mountain women were snatching up new cures and remedies from the magazine, abandoning their old ways of healing.
Sorry, ma'am, not today. I'll look for one at the center first thing back, I said.
Be obliged to get one. Nestor Riley's been reading it, and she told me in passing last year she ain't rubbed groundhog brains on her baby's sore teeth or needed to use the hen innards on the gums of her teeth in one since. And after she'd read about a good paste recipe that cured thrush, Nestor said, none of her 9 youngins ain't ever had to drink water from a stranger's shoe again to get the healing. From behind her, I heard the rattle of a copper dipper in a water bucket. One of Martha Hannah's daughters passed it to her mama.
For your ride, bookwoman, the girl said.
I handed her my worn leather-wrapped bottle Pod made, and she poured the sweet spring water into the container and passed it back. We exchanged books, and Martha Hannah and the youngins thanked me. The children snuck a touch to Junia's furry head, poked at the tufts of her spiky mane sticking up between her ears. Junia edged closer to the sill, leaned into the frame, enjoying the curious hands, nosing around for any vittles. Startled, the smaller youngin stepped back and screamed and laughed, while the two older ones squealed and boldly stroked her muzzle.
Read us a storybook, woman, one boy rang out.
I want to read White Fang, another said.
No, The Call of the Wild, a bigger boy insisted.
Shush, young'uns, where's your manners? Martha Hannah said. Bookwoman's had herself a long ride and even a longer one to go. I wished I had time to chat and read, but Martha Hannah understood she was my second to last stop on Mondays, and I had little daylight left. We'd make up for it in the summer hours, I promised her. Her husband, Devil John, a moonshiner, walked into the yard right past me, stone-faced, without a greeting. Martha Hannah spotted him over my shoulder and snapped,
"Get to your chores, young'uns. I need to get supper on the table quick. Finishing hulling them beans, Junior, and bring in the laundry, Letty and Colleen."
Her voice turned edgy and shrill.
"Carson!"
She leaned her head out the window and peered across the yard.
"Laws, you still ain't hold the garden? Get to it!"
Weren't 2 miles past the Smith's place when I spied Vester Fraser. Not really him, but his sneaky shadows. A dirty boot and the hem of his long topcoat poking out from behind a thick Kentucky coffee tree. I heard a soft nickering from his nearby horse. I sucked in a breath, feeling raw and exposed. That he'd been trailing me still left a sinking knot in my belly that rose in my throat like bile. Junia must have seen Fraser too, because she cried out and broke into a wild gallop. I held tight, letting her run off the path. Ahead, I saw a woman and child collecting berries. Grateful to see hill folk, I pulled Junia over and waited for them to pass. The boy stopped and pointed.
"Look yonder, ma'am."
When they drew close, I lifted a friendly hand, hoping to tell them about the library services. But the small young'un dropped the berry basket he'd been toting and cried out,
"Oh, ma'am, look, it's her. It's Blue Ghost you done told me about."
My greeting froze in midair. She yanked the little one's arm so hard he stumbled and yelped.
"Don't look at her, William,"
she warned, plucking up the basket and dragging him past me. The child's whimpers lifted into the natters of chasing swallows. Junia shifted toward the lost berries, and I squeezed my legs against her sides and tugged the reins. "Halt," I ordered the mule. The boy glanced back, and the woman tightened her hold and pulled him farther down the path, but not before I saw the wide-eyed fright in his eyes, the blame of childhood nightmares. I lowered my head, grieved that I was his. An hour later, I tethered the mule to a rotted porch rail and knocked on the door of my last patron. The 75-year-old woman hollered,
"If and that's Blewett, get on in here, child."
Relieved, I looked once over my shoulder and stepped inside. Loretta Adams sat at her small table that had a worm-eaten wobbly leg. In front of her, two empty cups waited on the delicate walnut-stained doily she'd tried to center. Squares of fabric were piled neatly on the edge. A stack of sewing cloths lay on a tick-covered ottoman nearby. Tallow candles cast warm light across the whitewashed walls and the homespun curtains, the scent of animal fats wafting from candle wax. Loretta held an Old Testament book in her aproned lap.
"Miss Loretta," I said softly, "it's me, Bookwoman."
"I knowed who it is, child. Poor sighted I am, not deaf."
"Yes, ma'am," I grinned and set down a book. Miss Loretta was nearly blind, a spinster who lived alone with only a nephew to check on her well-being. And then only when he weren't out on a tear for a month or more. Loretta still read some and had fine penmanship, but it wore on her eyes and she could only make out shadows at times, she claimed. Her hearing was good as most, her mind keen and full of sharp wit. She boasted how she could still whip the tightest stitch of anyone in Kentuck, sew the prettiest counterpane or fanciest church dress, a fine seamstress in her day, and occasionally I'd pass on a letter to her from folks writing to ask her to sew a christening, wedding, mourning, or church dress for them. Loretta's cabin was neat and tidy, though there weren't much to clean in the cramped area. The walls were darkened and baked from the wood stove, like all hill homes. But her bed was made, and she'd folded her quilt neatly across it, and I could tell she'd swept the floorboards and dusted some. A tea kettle sat atop her lit wood stovetop, sweating from steam. A skillet of molasses bread rested beside it, sweetening the musty air, and another pot of water beside that. Under the stove, two skinny cats, Myrtle and Milkweed, raised their furry white heads and yawned before returning to their nap. Loretta swished a clumsy hand across the table and grasped for the china cups she'd put there. She found them and pushed them toward me.
"You're late today. Get the book, then get us some tea, child," she said.
I pulled out a wedge of pine snuggled beneath the table leg, took my library book from the rickety table, and propped it under the leg, steadying the rattling cups and placing the old table on solid standing. I gathered the cups and walked over to the stove to pour our teas, and then turned and took a hearty gulp from mine before giving Loretta hers, grateful she couldn't see my greedy thirst. I wiped my mouth with a sleeve, eyes locked on the bread.
"Help yourself to the bread and bring the kettle over here and have yourself some more," she said. "There's plenty for seconds, child, thirds if you're hankering. We have us enough sassafras root and spring water in this old mountain to quench the whole country, and plenty of sweetbread today."
Feeling my face warm, I muttered, "Yes, ma'am." Even though she couldn't see well, I felt Loretta could see other, bigger things that most eagle-eyed folks missed. Still, I wouldn't take her bread. It might be all she had to see her through the week. I pulled out one of the old split-bottom chairs beside the table and sank into the woven seat Loretta had made with bark strip. Loretta handed me her Bible, and I opened it to the Book of Ruth where we'd left off and read until she tapped my leg with her walking stick some 20 minutes later.
"Get on home, child. Darkness is near."
I rubbed my eyes. Mountain shadows had seeped into the cabin, marbling the walls in black splashes. I stooped over, pulled the library book cautiously out from the leg, and replaced it with the pine wedge while my other hand gripped the table lip to keep the stuff from sliding off. I held the library book a moment and then said, "Miss Loretta, this is a Dr. Doolittle book, and I think you might like it some." Loretta held up a shushing hand and shook her head. "It's clean, Miss Loretta, and it's a good one about a nice doctor who talks to animals and—"
"Nonsense, child. And what I done told you before, I ain't letting you read me them government books."
"But
them's books about rubbish and devilish deeds. Foolishness. Take it on back."
"Yes, ma'am," I said, wishing she'd let me read her one from the library once in a while instead of her Bible. Every time I brought one, I thought she might take a liking to, she'd sour and rile on.
"Them city books ain't fitting for my kind. Ain't got a lick of sense in them pages for us hill folk. Nothing but foolish babble and prattle."
"No, ma'am. Yes, ma'am," I'd murmur agreeably. Loretta said,
It was 1857 when my papa toted this fine Bible and four of his mama's teacups all the way from Texas, where he preached, settling in these old Kentucky hills a good 4 years before me and sister was born. These all that's left of the teacup set. She jabbed a finger at the two delicate white cups with a gold trim around the lips and on the fancy ribboned handles. And this, Loretta tapped the Bible, was how he found his way. He had only one book and wanted me to know it too. Yes'm, it's a good one, I said. Now I know you have to bring 'em, child. She puffed up and smacked her long, frumpled skirts. But I still like mine best, and I ain't no cheat for it. Someone had told Loretta I only made stops to deliver books, though I told her it weren't true. When she brought it up, I said there were folks on my route I'd only read to, just not from their own book. Still, Loretta got it in her mind if we used the library loan as a table leg prop, and she made me take it when I left. She didn't feel like she was stealing from the government. No, ma'am, you ain't a cheat, I said. You're a fine hill woman, Miss Loretta. Loretta raised a proud head and bobbed it, her white bun unraveling, loosening a strand over her old ailing eyes. You rest now, and I'll be back soon to read more, I told her. Loretta pointed to the basket on the floor beside the door. Get you some root for you and your papa, child. She patted her hair in place and rose from the chair. Thank you, ma'am. Much obliged. I helped her hobble over to the narrow iron bed and took off her heavy shoes, tucked them under the bed frame beside her old Colt revolver. She fussed with her quilt and hung it over the bottom bed rail. Loretta pointed to the bulging covers at the foot of her bed. Oh, my bed pig needs filling, she said, standing back up. Let me get it for you, Miss Loretta. Bless you, child. I pulled out the pig-shaped pottery from under the counterpane, took it outside and unscrewed the lid atop its fat back and emptied the cold water out in the yard. In a minute, I'd filled the bed warmer with the hot water on the stove and tucked it back under Loretta's cover at the foot of the bed to give her heat that'd warm her for the night. My eyes are burning, Loretta said. I'm a tad tired. Can you spare another minute to help me with my eye wash, child? Yes, ma'am. I picked up a rag beside her basin on a tiny stand near the stove, dipped the cloth into the washbowl full of tincture, and wrung it. The tang of the old herb clung to my hand. Here, ma'am. I dropped the wet rag into her open palm, trying not to offend her with my touch. Loretta moved clumsily, and the cloth fell to the floor and our hands met. A tiny gasp slipped past my teeth. Before I could give the rag back, she groped for my hand, latched on, and said quietly in her old voice, "See all my fabric, child? Sure is a lot. Well, them claws are a lot like folks. Ain't much difference at all. Some of us is more spiffed up than others, some stiffer and still some softer. There's the colorful and dull, ugly and pretty, old new ones. But in the end, we's all fabric, cut from his cloth. Fabric, and just that." Yes, ma'am, I whispered. Now I know you're a blue, but these old eyes don't care, nor feels the colors none. It feels the heart, child, and it's a fine one. And you're a fine hill woman. The hard day suddenly landed at my feet, leached out my skin, and swept up into weary eyes. A tremble took hold of my hand, though it should have been that of Loretta's old weak one. But her touch was warm and firm, and she squeezed and pressed her other palm tightly on top, rubbing my flesh. I tilted my head upward, shuttering my eyes, the hurt and loneliness pooling inside, swelling. I tried to pocket my feelings, but today more than ever, I missed Mama. Her love, and mostly her gentle touch. As the days passed, I worried I'd forget her and know to certainty that because of my skin, it would be unlikely I'd feel that kind of touch from another. I was a blue ghost, the spook in little boys' bad dreams. My heart pained for Mama and for my ugly color and what Charlie Frazier had taken from me. There was the ugliness of the preacher, the hardness of this land, the shame weighing down my shoulders. It was always there inside. The disgrace had fixed itself to my soul like it had life. The rawness, black and heavy like a lump of Kentucky coal that would find its dirty way into our home.
A silence fattened and swelled as the candlelight herded shadows from nooks and crannies, tickling the cobwebbed ceilings. Loretta gently untangled our hands and said, "Let me get my eye medicine, child." I passed it to her, and she pressed the rag to her eyes, dabbing with the golden seal wash she'd brewed to help cure them. "Anything else I can get you, Miss Loretta?" Loretta pulled two tiny eye stones from her dress pocket and pushed them into my hand. "Would you mind rinsing these, child?" I took the flat, milky stones that she'd said had come from the innards of a hawk and dropped them into the pan of golden seal, swished, then dried them with a clean cloth the way she liked, and carried the rocks back over to her. The old woman laid back on the bed and slipped a stone under each eyelid, shutting her bulging eyes, hopeful the hill remedy would be a cure. "See you next Monday, Miss Loretta," I said. Beside the door, I squatted down to a basket stuffed full of ginseng, sassafras, and other herbs, picked out a small root and a big white willow bark, and slipped outside. I'd replace them this summer when the eyebright bloomed, bring her the old herb to nurse her eyes. I hated taking from her, knowing she couldn't hunt the herbs anymore and relied on her nephew for it. But the willow cured pains, calmed swelling, and cooled the hottest fever. Maybe it would take care of Mr. Moffat. An umbrella of coming dark and cold greeted me. Junia gave a soft, wind-down bray, and I mounted and pointed her toward home. I looked back once to wave, even though Loretta wouldn't see. Her cabin was half swallowed in shadow and rolling fog, haloed by fireflies chewing through the darkness. Ahead, the dark forest beckoned. I stopped to search for him, feeling his sneaky eyes on me, his blackness smothering. He was out there hunting, and I knowed it weren't for supper. Junia shifted, lifted her muzzle, feeling it too. I need the old mule, urging her to hurry. Chapter 11. Junia carried us home through the fog-drenched forest, not breaking until she saw the smoke curling from our chimney. "You're running late again," Pa said as I came through the door. "Sorry, Pa, folks are excited to have the library service back." "You read to old Loretta?" "Yes, sir. I read a good 20 minutes, then helped her to bed." I slipped out of my coat and hooked it on the peg beside the door. "Good," he grunted as he bent over to roll up the socks under his pant legs. Pa knowed Loretta only allowed the Bible, and he had a soft heart for the old woman. "I thought it was your night off. Where are you off to?" "Pa, you going out?" "Yep. Last night, Lee Sturgill's woman took to the bed, and I promised to work his shift for him tonight so he wouldn't have a rock dropped on his pay."
"The sheriff's daughter's ailing?"
"Birthing bed," Pa mumbled, looking away. Some of the coal miners had been calling on Pa a lot lately to work their shifts to avoid fines, keep them out of trouble with the company bosses. Remembering Loretta's tea, I dug out the root from my coat. "Miss Loretta gave us this. Let me brew you a cup of sassafras before you go."
"Another night, daughter. I can't be late. Get yourself some supper and rest up. Doc came by and left one of his baskets."
He crammed a foot into his work boot.
The old doc was the only one who did call beside the quarters Pod sent. More than once, the doctor had dropped off small gifts of apples, a jar of jam, or biscuits, all the while with whittling pleas to draw our blood, scrape our skin, or let him take us to the medical clinic in Lexington. Pa never answered the door and made him leave any gifts on the porch. Appreciative, I plucked up an apple and lightly bounced it from one hand to the other.
"Pa, I heard some stirring out there a while back." I pulled back the curtain and stared out the window into the fog, seeing nothing.
"I've seen a bobcat on the trail, and I thought I saw it over by the thorny locust when I came in this morning."
He gestured to the door.
"Bobcat? I'm not sure it's creatures, Pa. I
need to get going so the sheriff's daughter can be taken care of. I'll have a look in the morning. Keep your eyes peeled."
"Yes, sir." I sighed that I had to, that there was one more thing out there hunting me. Maybe if I told Pa about the preacher, he'd stay home and we would both be safe. I dropped the curtain and turned.
"Pa, a few weeks back, the preach—"
But he was out the door before I could finish. I stepped onto the porch and watched his ghostly lamp slash into mists until I could no longer see him. Frowning, I went back inside and rooted through Doc's basket. I found jam and bread and spread the preserves on several slices for my supper. In the lantern light, I hurried and did my chores, stopping to build another fire in the stove with some birch bark and pine kindling from the porch. Carefully, I placed a tinder of curling birch on the stove's cast iron floor, lit the nest, and stacked the pine splits atop the small flames. Fragrances of woods and resin filled the cabin. Hours later, I fetched Henry's present from my coat and climbed the loft ladder. I dropped the lifesaver onto the table beside the cotton mattress Pa insisted on getting me when he brought me home from Charlie Frazier's. I'd always slept just fine on a pallet of quilts, but Pa believed the mattress advertisement that promised to soothe hurt bones and give better rest would help me heal faster. Pa had credit to spend at the company store that he used for the purchase, saying he'd had a little extra that month. But Pa didn't have as much as 2 nickels to rub together, and I knowed he worked 18-hour days for 2 weeks straight for that little extra. The company didn't like for the Kentucky man to feel a dollar in his pocket, and they'd pay the miners mostly in company scrip, credit that could only be used at the company store to make sure of just that. If a feller balked at having to spend his pay there, he'd be dismissed right quick. The company also let workers draw on their earnings before payday, happy to give out scrip as loans with interest to keep the families good and indebted to them, insisting to any who might raise a brow, it serves to smarten the miners, gives the coal man a vicissitude from improper business standards, and educates them on sound business practices, on acquiring sound credit. I changed into my nightgown, turned back the covers, and snuggled under the quilt. My thoughts pulled back to Henry's precious gift. The hunger he suffered. Pa and I had seen our share of hunger. We only had the berries, morels, squirrels, rabbits, and other life we'd pinched from the forest. Sometimes Pa'd trade miners his kills for other foods we couldn't get, like eggs, corn, and fruit. Rarely could we afford the expensive staples at the company store. The company's scrip and my paycheck helped us to stay afloat a little, despite Pa using most of it to buy up the store medicines rather than a doctor's stronger ones to fight his lung illness. Still, he stayed in debt purchasing newfangled medicines, the next sure-fix potion that the store would bring in. Like a small bandage, the store-bought medicine would hide his sickness for a little bit, so that he could go back down into the mine and make more money for newer cures the company kept stocking and pushing on the miners. Weren't but 2 of us to fend for. The 300 or so scattered folks who populated our area lived in the woodlands and alongside creek beds, up slopes, and the few in town and out in the mine camp were mostly large families with many children. But there was a medicine for Henry and all the Henrys out there, for the hunger and hungry. Didn't seem right. Not much of the pox or influenza sickness in Kentucky as much as there was the hunger disease right now. That there were stores full of the cure for hunger kept me awake with that special kind of anger that comes from helplessness. I picked up the life